Governor's Office. I'd like to start with introductions of the committee members at the table. Of course, you've already met Justin Sr. Ms. Pierce? Dr. Moffitt?
Kathy Moffitt.
Ms. Lamb?
Stan Whittaker.
Chuck Corley with Department of Elder Affairs.
I'm Ann Swirlick, here for Amy Guinan today.
Dr. Rich Thacker, I'm an internist practicing here in Tallahassee representing the Florida Osteopathic Medical Association.
All right, and here at the front of the table, we have our speakers for today and other participants from Medicaid.
David Rogers, Assistant Deputy Secretary for Medicaid Health Systems.
Hi, I'm Dietra Kohl. I work in the Medicaid field office in Fort Myers, and I handle the Complaint Center.
I'm Melanie Brown-Wolfstrom, the Director of Community Relations.
And I'm Sue McPhee with the field office in Tampa, and I also manage the field-based plan management office.
And we have some members joining us by phone today. If those on the phone could go ahead and announce themselves.
Hi, this is Uta Gatsia with the Department of Children and Families.
Thank you.
Tammy Miller, Florida Dental Hygiene Association.
Thank you.
Sarah Sequenzia, consumer family member.
Ms. Sequenzia, welcome.
Douglas Manning, Executive Director for DentaQuest.
Lynn Cavallaro, University of Florida College of Dentistry.
Ed Zapert, Florida Department of Health.
All right, for the people here in Tallahassee, Dr.
Jeff Berman here, Florida Medical Association.
And who do we have on the phone from the Florida Department of Health?
Ed Zapert.
Okay, I'm going to turn it back over for Justin for a legislative update.
I actually don't have that much to say in terms of the legislative update. The legislature is not in session right now. I certainly would be happy at this point to open the floor if anyone has any questions about any statutes that were passed in the last legislative session, if they want any information or have any issues. But right now the legislature is not in session, and they have generally returned to their districts to run for office. With no questions, just to give you an idea of what the agency is doing, and before I turn it over to David Rogers, for the last several years, since 2011, when the legislature passed and the governor signed a bill creating the statewide Medicaid managed care program, we have been designing and implementing the statewide Medicaid managed care program, a program that will turn over and utilize health plans to provide for services to over 3 million Medicaid recipients in any given month. We've been working very hard with the federal government to get final approval of an 1115 waiver that will allow the program to go into operation. Right now we are operating under a 31-day temporary extension to our 1115 waiver, but we are hopeful that the waiver we will be able to reach an agreement on special terms and conditions with our federal partner at some point this week. If not, hopefully get another temporary extension, and we'll be able to iron out the final 1115 special terms and conditions within the first few days of August. So we are working diligently with our federal partners on that. So far, we have rolled the program out to most of the state, but I'll go ahead and turn it over to David Rogers to give a full update on where we are with the SMMC rollout.
Thank you, Justin. Good afternoon. We're actually nearing the end of the implementation for the statewide Medicaid managed care program, if you can believe that, with the last three of 11 regions set to go live for the managed medical assistance portion of the program on August 1st, beginning of next month. We had started the statewide Medicaid managed care implementation actually last year, last August 2003, with the rollout of the long-term care program. And the agency of that program, the agency contracted with Severn 7 different health plans, including a long-term care fee-for-service PSN. I think you have in your enrollment packet, members, a snapshot of the enrollment in those long-term care plans for that component of the statewide Medicaid managed care program. And we're actually entering into our second year then for those roughly 80,000 Medicaid recipients enrolled in the long-term care program or LTC program. With open enrollment, annual open enrollment, just finished for Region 7. That was our first region to go live in the long-term care program last August. And Regions 8 and 9, the annual open enrollment period is actually underway as we speak. The rollout of the managed medical assistance portion of the SMMC program has been, well, I won't say it's more intensive than long-term care, but it certainly is more condensed as we're in the process of transitioning, as Justin said, about 3 million individuals into to new 18 new managed care plans. And I say 18 new managed care plans. I should make note, you have a handout of the enrollment, current enrollment snapshot. Those are obviously all plans that have participated in Florida Medicaid for some time, but that were selected as a result of our competitive procurement for the MMA program. I should note also that this enrollment snapshot includes the regions that have gone live. Regions 1, 7, and 9, as you can see that from the note in the bottom, is are the three regions that are scheduled to roll out the first of next month on August 1st. We have right now, again, about roughly 2 million individuals enrolled in the program and about 900,000 roughly that are pending for enrollment in the remaining regions effective August 1st. Those new assignments, close to a million new individuals going into MMA next month, include about 50,000 enrollees in the Children's Medical Services Network program. That plan is a statewide plan, and it will go live across the state on August 1st. Also included in those pending enrollments are about 30,000 CHIP transitions. Those are individuals, children that are transitioning from Title 21, Children's Health Insurance Program, to Title 19, in accordance with the Affordable Care Act. Just kind of an update for after August 1st, we have a few to-dos, I think, that remain for the MMA program. First, we'll roll out the specialty plan for persons with serious mental illness in Regions 2, 4, 5, and 6 on September 1st. And this plan actually first went live in July with Regions 10 and 11. But the delayed rollout was primarily due to the need to establish specific capitation rates for that specialty population. So we're going back to open up enrollment for those earlier regions that went live prior to July. There's also an additional specialty plan that's slated to go live, but not until January of 2015. This is a plan for recipients who are dually eligible for both Medicaid and Medicare benefits, and individuals that have chronic conditions that, again, are dually eligible for both of those programs. That implementation date was targeted to align with the 2005 Medicare plan year. That Medicare contract runs on a calendar year basis, so that program will begin concurrent with that 2015 Medicare year. Healthy behaviors programming, which is a component of the SMMC statute, really designed to incentivize healthy behaviors among managed care enrollees, will be implemented by October. This is somewhat like our approach in implementing the participant-directed option in the long-term care program, where it lagged slightly behind the initial implementation so that we could focus on transitions initially and then bring some of the new programming online as, again, folks were enrolled and settled and through the continuity of care period. We also have broader provisions related to managed care plan marketing that are new under the SMMC contract. We've just I think this month, I believe, finalized our, well, kind of assembled a managed care oversight unit that's located in our Tampa field office. And we have some work to do some on that front as well. And Sue McPhee, who manages that unit, is going to share some more with you as we go through the agenda. I think also I'll hold off a little bit as we get into, as Deatra Cole will go over the complaint process, and we'll kind of give some context for that and maybe come back to some discussion in terms of so what the experience has been as we went through the rollout process. It has not been an easy process, as you might imagine. A lot of work in a very short period of time, not without challenges or issues, certainly. But as someone put it to me recently, it was a process that could have been extremely chaotic, and we're fortunate that it wasn't. So, again, we're nearing the end and kind of looking forward to getting into what we call steady state as we've transitioned, again, about 3 million lives into this new program.
Go ahead.
All right, I'll again open the floor for comments, questions, or discussion. Before I do, I just want to mention a few things about the rollout and things that we've been focusing on from the very beginning as we've done the rollout to try to ensure that the rollout is successful. We have defined success as we have approached the rollout, and our definition of a successful rollout is that there is continuity of care for recipients. And by that, what we mean is that if someone is undergoing a current course of treatment, that current course of treatment that started prior to the rollout will continue even after the rollout has come to that region. So the course of treatment will not be interrupted as a result of the rollout. In addition to that, when it comes to medical assistance, people don't always have an ongoing course of treatment. They're not always getting daily medical care. Oftentimes, they set appointments many months in advance. And our feeling is that any appointments that were set prior to the rollout in a region that where the appointment date is actually after the rollout, those appointments should be honored, and that we would make sure that the health plans that are coming to that region will pay for those appointments with those physicians or with those healthcare practitioners, even if that healthcare practitioner is not in their network. So continuity of care has been a focal point for us and will continue to be as we bring it to regions 1, 7, and 9. We've also tried to focus on the fact that when people make a choice about the plan that they're going to go into, that they have access to information about the people and the providers that are in network with that plan, and that they can make their choice based on very broad and accurate networks. And we've asked the plans to deliver to us on a weekly basis a file that lets us know who is in their network, and that file can then be driven out to our Choice Counseling website, as well as to our choice counselors who are answering the phone, so they can talk to people about the providers that are in network, and people can make a choice that's right for them and preserves continuity of care and gets them healthcare practitioners that they can feel comfortable with. We have also insisted that the health plans pay providers on a timely basis during the rollout. Sometimes health plans have a little bit different payment schedules than we do. We are a very prompt payer. We pay on a regular basis. We pay very quickly. And if you switch to this new program and the health plans have a different payment schedule or maybe don't pay as quickly, it can interrupt payroll at providers' offices all around the state. We did not want to see any provider payroll interruptions as a result of the rollout of this program, and that's been a touchstone that we've been focusing on to make sure that the rollout is a success. The last thing, of course, is that the website has the capacity to handle the number of people that are coming to visit it, and that our phone lines can handle the capacity of callers that are calling in to choose the plan that's right for them. So far, we were able to do that. It's really, actually, the rollout is over. Monthly Magic is done from a website and choice counseling perspective. And people still are in a period, a free agency period, if you will, where they can choose plans, but we don't expect anywhere near the call volume where we had hundreds of thousands of people that were actively calling and choosing plans over the course of the last several months. Doing the rollout in chunks, not doing it all at once statewide, certainly helped with our capacity, and we're very thankful to our contractor, Automated Health Services, for helping us make sure that the choice counseling process has been smooth and successful. Those are the four things that we've been looking at, and hopefully the rollout in 1, 7, and 9 is going to be smooth. We certainly will be looking at very specific issues around the early days of a rollout. We've been focused very much on pharmacy. There is generally a large amount of traffic at pharmacies on the first day of any month in a health program. Our program is no different in that regard, and it's very important that the pharmacies be able to see what plan a person is in and be able to fill the prescriptions for our members when they arrive at the pharmacy on day one. Also, transportation is a focus. If anybody is seeing any issues around these types of things, it's very important from a transportation perspective that someone be able to get to an appointment that they have made with their provider. If anyone is having any trouble, not just with transportation, not just with pharmacy, but with any issue with the rollout, it's important to reach out to our issue and complaint hub, and Dietra is going to talk a little bit more about that in the next few minutes. But it's very important that they reach out to us. Often these problems can be corrected almost immediately within a matter of hours in certain cases, but always quickly within a matter of a couple of days for most issues. And it allows us, when we get issues coming in, to aggregate issues and to sort them and to track them and try to figure out whether there is a problem that is entirely systemic and statewide, whether there's a problem with a specific plan, whether there's a problem with a specific region, whether there's a problem with a specific service, and or whether it's just a one-off that we can correct as a one-time thing. But it's important that we have to know about it in order to solve it, and don't feel bad about bringing us issues, whether you are a recipient, whether you are a stakeholder or an association, a professional association, whether you are a provider, anyone can come to us, a sister state agency can come to us and talk to us about the things that they're experiencing. Let us know if they have any problems. With that, I'll open the floor to the committee if there are any questions about the rollout. The question is whether the folks that are duly eligible for Medicare or Medicaid are going to be optional to enroll or whether they're going to be mandatory to enroll. And the answer is that depends. And there are a couple of different types of dual eligibles. There are certain folks that are only eligible for, they're not actually eligible for Medicaid benefits through the Medicaid program. They're only eligible for cost sharing. In other words, they use Medicare to receive their services, but they have premiums and co-payments that they have to make, and Medicaid helps them with those premiums and co-payments. The folks that aren't receiving any services through the Medicaid program but are only eligible for cost sharing, they don't have to join a managed care plan. They're not going to be in a managed care plan. For the folks that are fully dual, these are folks that are eligible for both Medicaid and Medicare. Medicare is primary. Medicare is going to cover things like physician visits and hospital visits, things that Medicare covers. And we offer wraparound services. And yes, they will be required to go into a managed care plan through the SMMC program.
I had a quick question. Oh, Stan.
Sure. Sorry.
Stan
Whitaker.
Hello.
There you go.
When these services are offered before, while this is in transition, and a provider sees a patient that is with one of the managed care plans and provides a service for that, when that managed care reimburses that provider, do they reimburse them at a different rate?
That's a good question. Under the requirements of our contract, for the first 30 days after rollout, the provider has to be reimbursed at the exact same rate that they are reimbursed in the month prior to the rollout for the same service.
And if that doesn't happen, we need to see young Dietra over there.
That's correct. Contact the issue and complaint hub, and we'll make sure that you get paid promptly, and at the appropriate rate.
Hi, this is Sarah Sequenzia. I had a similar question to the dual enrollment question. How does this impact people on the home and community-based med waiver through APD?
People who are eligible for the waiver, who are on the waiver, with the Agency for Persons with Disabilities or who are on the waiting list for the for waiver services through the Agency for Persons with Disabilities, no matter whether they're dual eligible.
People who are actively receiving services and get a Medicaid card or MediPass through the waiver.
Let me start again. People who are on the Agency for Persons with Disabilities waiver or people who are on the waiting list for services through the Agency for Persons with Disabilities waiver, no matter whether they're dual eligible or not, are voluntary for this program. That means that they can choose to be in a managed care plan for their medical assistance services, or they can choose not to be. They're also voluntary for the long-term care program. But it's important to understand that you are not eligible for two waivers at once. You cannot be on both the long-term care waiver and on APD's DD waiver. So it's important that you understand, or anyone in that situation understands very thoroughly what the options are for them. I think that there are a lot of situations where someone will voluntarily choose to go into a health plan for the medical assistance program, but I would think for the vast majority, if not all, of APD folks that are actually on the APD waiver, that they should not switch to the long-term care waiver.
Thank you very much. That was a great answer. Thank you.
Mr. Secretary.
Thank you. I had a question. This is along the same lines as a dual eligible patient. In the office yesterday, I had someone that had received a letter, and they were assigned to stay well. And I say assigned in the sense that the patient nor her son, you know, really understood it. They brought the paper in it, and it seemed factual and everything for me, but it was a little bit complicated for them, and they certainly didn't recall having selected one or the other, so I assume it was assigned, and these are folks in Region 2 and in particular in the Jefferson County. But what I didn't understand and couldn't explain, and I assumed once again they were assigned a physician and it wasn't me. So I'd been this lady's physician for a number of years. And so there was a physician, I assume, who was in her area code, because it's in Jefferson County as well, and they didn't want to have to switch. So obviously I referred them to the number on the form, you know, if there was any concern. But my question basically is the process on how that does work.
For Region 2, Region 2 went live back on May the 1st. The choice period would have started back in mid-February and run through mid-April. When we go about the process of opening up the choice counseling lines, we actually, at the very outset of it, make an attempt to match a recipient with a health plan. And there are a number of different factors that we look at as we try to make that match. If there is a specialty plan that they appear to be clinically eligible for, we will assign them to that specialty plan. In some cases, they appear to be clinically eligible for more than one specialty plan, and we have developed a hierarchy around which specialty plan they would go to. If they are not eligible for a specialty plan, we would try to match them with one plan or the other. There are two plans in Region 2 that are general. One plan or the other that appears to match their utilization history the best, and we do our best effort to try to match their utilization history. If both plans are equal in that regard, or if there is no utilization history that would give one plan, the primary care physician is one plan and not in the other, there's nothing that would give one plan the edge, then it is done round robin, in essence, by family unit. But it is done at the beginning of the 60-day process, and we send them a letter saying you have been assigned to this plan. However, you have the opportunity to learn about other options that are available in your region, and you can call this number and you can switch plans during the 60-day open enrollment period. Then there's also notification of the fact that after they've selected a plan or after they've started and they've gotten enrolled in a plan, that they have 90 days to switch plans for any reason. And we don't really recognize 31-day months. So it turned out to be, I think, 92 days for certain populations. That's generally how the process works. Now, the assignment to a particular physician, that's up to the plan. And that person could potentially change their assignment back to you so that you would be their assigned physician. They'd have to talk to their plan about that.
I can foresee a, you know, a concern. This just kind of thinking, you know, about contingencies, but I could foresee a concern where if we assign to the plan, and I appreciate the work and the thought that goes into that to try to match the patient with the most appropriate plan, but then, as I understand your statement, then the plan itself would assign the doctor, if and so they probably don't have any particular track record taking into account, you know, the patient's previous physician, who I'm sure more often, much more often than not, would like to stay with their previous physician. So the issues may come up. Is there any way that we can try to facilitate that the plan puts as much effort as the state does to match the plan? Can the plan then in turn put that degree of effort into matching with the physician, and not just by zip code, but by previous utilization and availability? And and then I guess the corollary to that is that I could foresee an issue where their previous long-term physician may not be with all of the particular plans, you know, within that region, and may only be with one or the other. Mm-hmm. Then we've got to go even further back to correct that.
We try to share as much information as we can so that the plans can make those types of matching decisions. I think if you feel like, as a recipient, that you are not matched up with the right plan, that you should reach out to the plan and see if you could get that assignment change and talk with them about changing your primary care assignment, if that's how they're going to do it, and making sure that you get the physician that you would like to have. It's certainly a possibility that all plans in a region wouldn't. A doctor might not participate with every plan in a region, and in that case, it's possible that certain doctors could drive choice in that regard. That people who want to see a certain doctor will switch out of the plan that doesn't have that doctor and switch into the plan that does. It's certainly something that we anticipate seeing in the coming months and years, and will be a feature of the program.
Dr. Thacker, again, just on those switches, I assume they change at the first of the next month. You know, I know that typically with complaints we're trying to resolve same day or within a day or two. I assume in this sort of scenario, it's probably the first of the next calendar month.
In most instances, you're correct, Dr. Thacker. It would be the first of the next calendar month if you tried to switch plans. During the initial rollout, however, if you're not in a plan, you can, in the continuity of care period, the pre-existing appointment should be honored. You can go ahead and feel comfortable honoring it, and you can bill the plan and be paid at the your pre-existing rate prior to the rollout.
Thank you.
So Stan, you're recognized. Go ahead.
After the 91 days.
After the, this is Stan with Nurse Practitioner Association. After that 91 days and that final rollout, can they change at any time after that, or are they stuck there for the rest of the year?
After the 90 days has expired, you're in what we would call a lockout period, and then you would have another 60-day choice period in advance of an annual change date. So you have an annual opportunity to switch plans. I would note, however, that there are good cause reasons why you could change plans at any time. There is a rule around good cause reasons. I think that they're fairly well known. I hesitate to give examples here because I would fear that I would miss some. I would imagine that Ms. Swerlick would probably have a good idea of what they are and would be on top of it because they help. She's someone that helps Medicaid recipients on a regular basis and is aware of the reasons that someone could have to change plans outside of the open enrollment periods.
A lot of our Medicaid recipients don't necessarily come in within that 90 days, and when they do come in and they realize that they're not satisfied or they're not seeing a provider or they're decide that it's the distance is too far, or they, don't take advantage of that 90 days. So what they would need to do is to do what? Would they need to call DITRA about that, or who do they talk to? Do they talk the counseling line?
The easiest way with that would be to contact our issue and complaint hub. At that point, we would be able to track and triage that complaint. We would have an intake unit. We would track it, and then we would track its resolution and take it all the way to resolution. And if it did appear that the person was raising an issue with us that did create a good cause reason to switch plans, then the resolution to that would be we would allow the person to switch plans. Ordinarily, that would happen on the first of the next month, but there's certainly ways we could do it manually to make sure that it happened right away as well.
Jessica, can I add just a bit? This is David Rogers. Just wanted to let people know that in terms of the complaint hub or how we're handling complaints, even calls or complaints or, in that case, a good cause request that comes in through the choice counseling line will flow to our complaint hub so that we see kind of everything in one picture. So it's really, we're trying to approach it as a no.
As a no wrong door, right? So however the complaint comes in, it gets to a place where we can see it and process it and handle it. So again, you can call the 800 number that will get kind of right into our contact center, which is Medicaid staff. But if you go through the choice counseling line, it will eventually get there. And then I just wanted to add, kind of going back to Dr. Thacker's question, just to note a couple of pieces of information that we give to plans. So there's a couple different ways that we pass the primary care provider onto plans. If an individual during the choice counseling process selects a specific provider, which they often do, they're not required to, but they'll say, I want Dr. Thacker, and you know, and he's in this plan, that will pass with the enrollment file that comes from our choice counselor, our enrollment broker, to the plans. And that's just kind of a routine transaction that occurs every month and has with our previous managed care programs. For the statewide Medicaid managed care program implementation, we did something different, and we took basically our history. So where we had a utilization history that identified the primary care provider, whether that was the previous MediPass assignments or from encounter data from the managed care plans previously, we passed that information onto the managed care plans as well, along with pharmacy data, authorization data, and really a number of other kind of critical data elements that the plans could use in their onboarding of new enrollees.
Ann, go ahead. You're recognized.
Okay. Now, just to follow up on the good cause question, this is something my office has done a lot of looking at and talking with various people on this issue, and it's based on federal and state law. There's some very broad reasons out there for why people could request disenrollment, and we'd actually prepared a brochure about this at some point, which we need to look at again. We haven't updated it since this rollout, but I think there's a big education component to this that people need to know that, you know, if they're that they're not necessarily stuck in a plan if they've got some good, you know, reasons to get out before their open enrollment. So I'd be happy to talk with you later about that.
Okay, any other questions from the group around about rollout?
The DD waiver you're saying should not go into a managed program?
Everyone who's in the DD waiver or on the DD waiting list is voluntary for both the long-term managed care program as well as the managed medical assistance program. What I said was is that I do envision there might be a lot of situations where someone who's on the DD waiver on the waiting list might want to go into the managed medical assistance program. It shouldn't be very I wouldn't think it would be very common at all that someone's on the DD waiver would want to go into the managed long-term care program. I will say also that if someone feels like they've made a mistake in that regard, we can help them with that. We would not. This is not a game of gotcha. We try to make sure they're in the right situation. When people are in the DD waiver, they use the waiver to receive a lot of long-term services and supports, and it's a fee-for-service system. It's not a managed care model. They are technically eligible for the managed long-term care model. But there, in most instances, I don't think it would be in their best interest to join the managed long-term care model, and so they shouldn't. And if they mistakenly do so, bring it to our attention, and we can help them with that.
But they can stay with Medicare, Medicaid.
They can stay where they are. Now, there may be some situations where they do want to be in the managed medical assistance program. They can be in the managed medical assistance program and be in the DD waiver, and there may be additional benefits associated with that. There may be additional providers associated with that. So that might be a choice that they do want to logically make, but they're voluntary. So if they do choose a plan, a medical assistance plan, they can choose to get out of it anytime they want to and go back to fee-for-service. Dr. Moffitt, you're recognized.
Thank you. Kathy Moffitt. On behalf of the health plans, I just wanted to mention one thing that hasn't been said on the PCP issue. The health plans, my health plan, and I think most of our colleague health plans in the SMMC program are making a tremendous amount of, are extended a tremendous amount of efforts to try to reach out to recipients in the first 30 days to 60 days after these regions go live, with welcome calls, with live calls, and provider outreach to try to hook up the primary care provider and the enrollee for that first visit after enrollment. There's a tremendous amount of effort. The plans are extending, and we're asking the providers to partner with us on that. The enrollment tape itself, what David says is true. We are able to see on the enrollment tape everyone's best effort to try to connect the enrollee to their historical PCP, but nothing is perfect. And even in my own plan, I'm sure other plans would say this too, we don't always get it right. But those efforts to try to connect the PCP to the enrollee in the first 30 to 60 days will often ferret that out. And we will often discover as we attempt to connect those people that we have connected them to the wrong person and we can make that adjustment. So that's an important thing I want to make sure everyone understands, that that's a very active process in the first 30 to 60 days into implementation.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments on the rollout before we switch to the next item on the agenda?
Mr. Secretary, just a point of order.
Dr. Thacker.
And we can do this later, certainly, but should approve the minutes
from the previous meeting, sure.
Okay. I actually, excuse me, Chris. Dr. Thacker, Carla and I discussed this, and we were going to hold the approval of the minutes until the next meeting. She has emailed them out to everyone and asked for comments back. So if you can go ahead and send your comments back to Carla, we'll go ahead and add that to the next meeting agenda to do both this meeting and our prior meeting minutes, okay?
I'll go on record and no comment.
Thank you.
Do we have a comment from someone on the phone? Okay, with that, I will turn it over to our area office manager for the Medicaid program in the Fort Myers area, which is our Region 8, Deidre Cole.
Hello. As was mentioned, my name is Deidre Cole. I'm working in the Fort Myers field office, and we have been tasked with coordinating the statewide Medicaid managed care complaint process. You staff locally in my office, and we also use staff in the other field offices to research and resolve complaints. Our definition of complaint is very broad. It's basically any expression of dissatisfaction, either with the statewide Medicaid managed program in general or with any of the managed care plans. We have been actively encouraging all stakeholders, providers, recipients, other state agencies, anyone, to report issues to us as they arise. Some of them are complaints. Some of them are just they need help navigating. They have questions, concerns. And, again, we're actively soliciting all issues. We record the issues as they're reported to us, so they may or may not be substantiated. Once we get the issues, we then, within a 24-hour window, assign them to staff so that they can reach out to the complainant to confirm that we got their issue, get some more information, and then we determine if we need to reach out to the plan, do we need to reach out to some policy folks with the agency to see how we can best address their concerns. We do leave the issues open in our system until we've been able to confirm with the person who reported it that it's been resolved. That can inflate the time frame and look like it's taking longer to resolve issues, but we really want to make sure that once we've done our research, we've talked to the plan, talked to senior management if necessary, we can loop back with the person that reported it to us to make sure that we did address their issue. As David mentioned, the Complaint Center receives our complaints via the online form, and that's on the statewide Medicaid Managed Care website. I hope most of you are familiar with it. There's a little button where you just click report a complaint. It opens up. You can fill out the information. You hit submit. It comes directly to staff in my office who are monitoring it. And we do monitor those submissions 24/7. So if an urgent issue comes in after hours, we do have staff checking the complaint box, and we will contact the recipient, contact the plan as needed to resolve those issues. Example of an urgent issue would be someone's at the pharmacy on a Saturday and they can't get their prescription. We want to make sure that we call the pharmacy, we call the plan if necessary, and call the recipient, try to get that resolved so they're not waiting until Monday to get their prescription. Just to give you some basic numbers, through the week of July 18th, we've recorded 4,200 complaints and issues since statewide Medicaid managed care started. 1,967 of those are related to the managed medical assistance piece, and we've actually closed 1,845 of those. And just so you know, the MMA implementation, we started rolling that out on May of this year. For long-term care, 2,233 are associated with the long-term care program, which started back in August. And as of the 18th, we'd closed 2,106 of those. For the long-term care portion, we found at least to date about 53% of the issues have been reported by providers, 39% recipients. Conversely, the MMA program, to date, it's been about 59% recipient and 40% provider. To give you some examples for long-term care, most common issues we've been receiving about long-term care have been related to provider payment. Concerns about how do I get paid, maybe my claims are denying, am I billing correctly, am I not billing correctly. We actually talk to the provider, we get some examples, we reach out to the plan so that they can get with the provider and see what the problem is to get them paid. We've also had another main reason has been continuity of care. And when I say continuity of care, I mean concerns about continuity of care. It may or may not mean missed services. It could be a recipient used to get their supplies on Tuesday, and now the date is Thursday, and they're just worried that they may not get them. We want to alleviate those concerns, make sure the plan's aware of the situation so that they don't run out of supplies. In fact, for the long-term care program, as we were rolling out, we actually made outbound calls to long-term care recipients who were in the community to actually ask them, are you getting your services? Do you have any questions? And, in fact, we were soliciting complaints to make sure that we could address issues quickly. The last major issues that we were having for long-term care related to system issues and file errors. Plan enrollment's based on residential county code in our system, and so we identified situations where maybe the county code was incorrect, so the plan enrollment was incorrect, and so we actually had to work through those issues. Those were agency issues, not necessarily plan issues, so we worked on those case by case as well. For the managed medical assistance piece, again, most common issue we're having come up right now is related to continuity of care. We're finding that a lot of that has to do with recipients who did not have to participate in managed care in the past, and they're not necessarily missing any services, but they're worried about what this means for them. Will I still get the services I need? Will I still be able to see the doctors I was seeing in the past? And so we educate them. We explain about the continuity care period so that they know that, yes, you will continue to get their services, and also to let them know if that doesn't happen, here's how you report a complaint so that we can research your specific instance and get that taken care of for you. We also have had a lot of questions about provider enrollment, providers that want to enroll in the new MMA plans. How do we do that? Who do we contact? The information's out there, but some of the providers just aren't aware of it, or they've submitted information to the plan, you know, and they want to know the status of their application. We help get the status for them and hook them up with the plan so they can get the information they need. Another main area has been choice counseling. We have recipients who get the materials, they pick a plan, but then they have questions or they're not sure they did the right thing. It'll come in on a complaint form. We'll make an outbound call to answer their questions. We have staff in my office who can change their plan if needed to make sure they get into the right plan. So we've been working through a lot of those issues as well. in my office, we focus primarily on, you know, documenting the complaint, researching the complaint, contacting the complainant quickly, and then closing it out once we've looped back with them. We document this information, and Medicaid senior leadership looks at it daily, and they use it to identify trends or other potential systemic problems and work directly with the plans to address those issues while we're working on, you know, an individual problem. I think it's been a great group effort. It really has helped us identify and fix things quickly and also kind of get ahead of any potential problems that could arise. Thank you.
At this point, we'll open the floor back up for any questions or comments about the issue and complaint intake hub down in Fort Myers. Anybody have any questions about it, any issues? Secretary Corley, you're recognized.
More of a question. You talked about these. You're starting to look at analyses and trends and all of what you're seeing. Do you anticipate now or in the future at some point reports on that that may be useful from the consumer side that they may be able to, particularly when their next open enrollment period comes around and they want to reconsider their plan or other options that might provide useful information from a consumer perspective?
Yeah, I'll take that. We think so. We think it can be a really valuable source of information. We've been doing it for long-term care for some time. MMA is a little bit new for us. I will say that I think we still probably have some work to do in making some of our classification system a little bit more meaningful, particularly from a consumer perspective. As Deatra said, we look at the complaints every day. I mean, every single complaint every day and look at that. So it's really less critical in terms of our approach to implementation, which is kind of focused on resolving those individual issues. And if they're trends, we kind of know it because we see it. As we get to steady state, I think we'll probably need to do a little bit of refinement and clarify some of the groupings and how the data is presented to probably make it a little bit clearer.
Just one quick comment to add. And that is that we just have to think about how we would present the data. An example would be, and I'll use Coventry as an example, they're in Region 11. There's another plan, Preferred, that's in Region 11. It may be that Coventry ends up with more complaints than Preferred, but they have twice as many members. And so we need to think about how we present that in terms of letting people actually compare apples to apples to make sure that they're utilizing the information and we're giving them the information in the most accurate form we can give it to them.
Thank you. I'm Jesse Fry with the AIDS Institute. When I was beta testing the online complaint form early on, I noticed that it didn't send you like a copy of the complaint that you had just registered. I don't imagine that's like a legal thing or a public records thing. Is that been fixed or is
it
that?
Has been.
Okay.
So you put in a valid email address and it will email you a copy of what you submitted.
Great. So I gave you an opportunity to. That's hugely helpful because, as you know, sometimes case managers are making those complaints on behalf of clients. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Celeste Putnam with FATA. Some of our members report that the complaint line is working very, very well for individual specific issues and that they will call in their issue and it will be resolved. However, the same issue keeps happening over and over and over again with some health plans. When we have that kind of trend identified, who should we contact within the agency with that type of information?
We certainly make every effort to identify that sort of trend internally and to take action against the health plan. Our relationship with the health plan is a contractual one, and in many cases we have the ability to impose liquidated damages or take some other action against the health plan, freeze their enrollment. There are some levers that we could turn if it gets to that point. We do feel like so far the health plans have been very responsive to the concerns that we've raised. If something is systemic, It can take a little longer to fix, however, than if something is a one-off. And even if people are bringing us issues one at a time, we can often fix them manually one at a time, but the systemic issue takes a little bit longer to fix.
Who should we let know? I know it takes a while to fix. Who should we email?
I would still encourage you to call the issue hub and say you believe that there's a systemic problem or there is a health plan specific problem.
Hey, Celeste, this is David Rogers. If you put it into the hub, again, we will see it. One of the things that I would encourage everyone to do is to make sure that the plan is identified. And I know as we eventually do the research, we kind of get to that, but particularly as we're looking at it, kind of folks are around the table every day looking at that, it really helps. We have a meeting where, again, management looks at what comes in every day. Following that meeting, there's a number of contract managers here. Contract managers meet on a daily basis, and there's a link with folks, managers, going from the initial meeting and review to back to the contract managers that then kind of go to the plans. And so what we often see issues that might be applied to multiple plans, and the Atrin folks actually will duplicate those. If a complaint comes in, it's about plan A, plan B, and plan C, we'll actually see three different complaints registered, but I would encourage folks to make sure where it is a plan specific issue to identify the plan. But if it's in the hub, we'll see it.
And you're recognized.
Just had a question about if there's still telephone access to the complaint. Can people call in a complaint, and if so, like, what are the numbers there? Because I know there's still people who don't have their own computers.
Anyone can call the number they have for the Medicaid field office in their region, and if they call that number and tell them that they have a complaint, they will actually submit it to my office on their behalf. So they do have that option as well. If they don't have internet access, they can make a phone call.
Thank you. My name's John Moyle. I'm with the Moyle Law Firm here and have been following these meetings and appreciate the chance to ask a question. I actually had two, but one was, if I heard roughly those numbers right, in the long-term managed care, you had a 60% complaint rate by providers, 40% by recipients, and it seemed like it was the reverse of that in the statewide managed care, roughly. And I was kind of curious as to if you all have given thought or could answer the question, why do you think that trend is there? Or
I would be speculating, but there's nothing I like better than to speculate. if I had to guess, when you're going into long-term care, the providers are providing care on a daily basis, and so they're going to be bringing issues on behalf of recipients to people's attention and to the health plan's attention. When you go into medical assistance, people aren't seeing a doctor on a daily basis most of the time, and some of the issues that they arise, any questions that they have will be personal to them, and they'll call themselves to raise those questions. So that's probably why the numbers flipped. I can't say that that's the product of any intensive studying on our part, but that would be my guess, is that while providers were bringing the issues to our attention in the long-term care program, that they were bringing issues to our attention on behalf of recipients because they were having daily contact with the recipients.
Thank you. And then if I could, I had one just for David. He's talked about the rollout. And one thing I don't know that, at least it wasn't clear to me, is that you say you try to get to the solid state, I think, is what the goal is.
Steady state.
I'm sorry.
Solid will work, too.
I got it confused.
We'll go with solid.
That's the battery, I think. So anyway, my bad. From a timing perspective, and you mentioned that you go in gulps, but when you go into a region, you don't do it all on the first day. I guess there's a population you take and do it, and it takes some period of time. But at what point in time do you say, okay, we're done with this region? Is it a 90-day, 120-day? And do you see that actually working? Like, if your target is 120, at 120, have you said, okay, we're fully implemented, or is it taking, you know, longer than that?
Well, different ones of us may have different definitions of it, but the way that I think of it is that there is a 60-day continuity of care period after the region rolls out and a 90-day period after someone has been enrolled in a plan where they could change plans for any reason. And really, after you get through those first 90 days in a region, there may be some issues on day 120 or day 125. To my mind, they become much more operational issues at that point. It's not a rollout issue 4 or 5 months in. It's an operational issue. That doesn't make it any less important to us. It's something that we're still going to try to track and identify. The centralized issue and complaint intake hub is still going to be there. We're still going to be trying to stay on top of the things that are going on around the state. But that's it. And as we switch from the rollout to steady state, the definition of success changes. You know, what we need now are rising HEDA scores. We need a low preventable hospitalization rate. We want to see a low cesarean birth rate. We want to see healthy birth outcomes. The definition of success changes as we switch to operations. But at the same time, we still want the program to be successful. We just change the definition of success and move past rollout issues around whether our website has capacity for this huge number of people that are going in at one time, and we switch, and whether providers have their payroll interrupted by the rollout itself, into, well, now how do we get to success? How do we get to the outcomes that we want to drive through this program?
Can I? This is David Rogers. I just a couple of things in terms of steady state. So Justin's right. Everybody goes day one, and then we have that 90-day period. So that when a region goes, it goes. And that's why it's so intense in terms of the transition and the data sharing. We do have some other things, as I mentioned. So we have the Healthy Behaviors Program. We'll see more marketing as we stand up that unit going. And then we'll have a big probably impact again around the first of the year or going into the latter part, going into the first of next year, as we present the opportunity for those full benefit dual eligibles to kind of realign or adjust to potentially their Medicare managed care enrollment. And so we'll see a couple of other, I think, pretty heavy points of contact around choice and again getting folks into the most appropriate care setting.
And there you have I'll use Coventry as an example because they're a plan that has a Medicare product in Miami. They have a Medicaid product in Miami. They have a CHIP product in Miami. And they have an exchange product, I believe, in Miami, as well as commercial. And there's an opportunity on January the 1st for someone with a family with different, one little kid in Medicaid, one little kid in CHIP, parents want to buy something on the exchange, or maybe somebody's dual eligible, they have the opportunity to get their family into one plan where they're coordinating, where one company, one organization is coordinating their care. So that's going to be an opportunity. You're recognized.
Thank you for the plug, Mr. Secretary.
A lot of other plans have that too, by the way. But I
did you run that by Sue? No.
This is Kathy Moffitt on behalf of all the plans. And I just wanted to mention that we have an all-plan call, all of the plans, with the agency on a weekly basis as we've been implementing all of the regions for MMA. And one of the very helpful things for the plans is to hear on a somewhat ad hoc basis the highlights from the complaint hub. And I think that's helpful not just for the plans maybe that are at the focal point of the complaint, but for all plans to have a heads up on what is occurring out there and how to best avoid having complaints from our recipients in those areas. So we on behalf of the plans, we thank you for that. That's extremely helpful information that we receive on a weekly basis. And frankly, if we could get even more trending detail, that would be great. If there are complaints that you see clustering around how long-term care providers are being paid, if we could understand a little bit more about what the details are, you know, is that crossover claims? Is that timeliness? What is that? That would, as we go on, that would be extremely helpful. And maybe that's an opportunity for us to partner together and determine what kind of information we could share. We would appreciate that.
Appreciate that. Are there any other questions or comments around the issue and complaint hub? It's been really, I think, one of the most successful features of the new program. getting ourselves to the point where we are running just one program and can centralize our operations and can centralize these types of features and make sure that we can run the best program that we can. It's really been helpful to us organizationally. It's been a major asset. Okay, with that, we'll move on to the next item on our agenda. And we have another area office manager coming in. This is our area office manager, Sue McPhee, in Tampa. And she's going to be talking about managed medical assistance and the plan's marketing activities. And here we go.
Thank you. Everybody should have a PowerPoint copy in their handout, and Kristen's going to click for me, so, okay. Well, as David said, under statewide managed care plans do have an expanded ability to conduct marketing activities. And so the agency, of course, needs to have a way to be able to approve the materials that are being used and to approve the events and other activities that the plans intend to use in order to enroll. A little bit high. Is this better? Okay. Sorry. Okay. So just wanted to review with you some of the definitions of the types of materials that plans can use in marketing and the types of activities and events that plans are allowed by the contract to engage in. So the federal definition of marketing is any communication to a Medicaid beneficiary from a plan who's not enrolled in that entity that can reasonably be interpreted as intended to influence the beneficiary to enroll in that plan. So, and marketing materials are those materials that are produced by or on behalf of the plan and can be reasonably interpreted as intended to market to a potential enrollee. That federal definition was included in the core contract, and it's defined in the core contract as any activity or communication conducted by or on behalf of any managed care plan with a Medicaid recipient who's not enrolled with the managed care plan or an individual potentially eligible for Medicaid that can reasonably be interpreted as intended to influence such individual to enroll in the particular plan. Some of the other federal requirements relating to marketing that have been incorporated into our core contract include managed care plans are prohibited from distributing marketing materials without prior approval from the state. They may not contain false or material misleading information. They're required to distribute the marketing materials throughout their specified service area. The plans are prohibited from directly or indirectly engaging in door-to-door, telephone, or other types of cold call marketing. And cold call marketing is defined as any unsolicited personal contact by the plan for the purposes of marketing. The plans must also ensure that prior to enrollment, individuals receive sufficient information in a language and format that's easily understood to make an informed decision regarding whether to enroll in a particular managed care plan. So some of the materials that we will be reviewing and approving or denying include branding and written materials. Branding includes marketing through mass communication, usually in some form of print media, such as newspapers, magazines, billboards, and always with the purpose of influencing a prospective enrollee to enroll and contact the managed care plan for more information. Written materials are those printed informational materials that are targeted to individual recipients, which promote the managed care plan, including but not limited to items such as brochures, flyers, leaflets, or other printed information. Written material includes materials for circulation by physicians, other providers, or third parties as well. Included in marketing materials are scripts, marketing scripts, and broadcast scripts. Marketing scripts would be the standardized text that's used by the plan in verbal interactions with potential enrollees designed to provide information and or to respond to questions and requests and are intended to influence such individual to enroll in the managed care plan. Marketing scripts include any text that's included in interactive voice recognition and on-hold messages used by the plans. Broadcast scripts include the written text of messages transferred or transmitted to a large group of people by managed care plan staff through a form of mass communication, such as television, radio, or social networking designed to promote the managed care plan and influence individuals to enroll. Kind of the key phrase here. Other marketing materials include promotional activities, such as drawings, prizes, giveaways, or any promise of a free gift accompanying the provision of marketing materials or activities, cannot be structured with the intent to give recipients or enrollees items totaling more than $50 per year, and there can be no obligation to enroll in the managed care plan associated with such activities. Nominal gifts are items that are used to attract the attention of potential enrollees and are permissible as long as the gifts are of nominal value and provided regardless of enrollment. Nominal value is defined as an individual item or service worth $15 or less based on its retail value. Other marketing activities include formal and informal events. Formal events are typically structured with an audience presenter style of presentation, with a managed care plan formally providing specific information using often a PowerPoint presentation or other type of presenter audience type of format. All personal and individual appointments with recipients are also considered marketing events. Informal events are, just as they're described, a little less formal than the formal events, usually in a less structured presentation, often using a table or a kiosk, maybe an RV, that's staffed by a representative of the managed care plan who can discuss the merits of the plan. Personal and individual appointments are those one-on-one appointments that typically take place in the recipient's home. However, they could happen in a coffee shop or a library. All personal or individual appointments with recipients are considered marketing events and must be limited to discussion of products that were agreed to by the recipient and may not include marketing of any related product beyond the scope agreed upon by the recipient and documented by the managed care plan prior to the appointment. And the managed care plan does that through the scope of appointment, which is a structured format for documenting the scope of a personal individual appointment agreed upon by the recipient. So these are the types of marketing materials and activities that the agency will be reviewing and approving before the managed care plans can conduct marketing activities. We actually began our foray into marketing about March, when we pulled together a group of staff in the Tampa office, provided training on the marketing provisions of the contract, and allowed the plans to submit branded written materials for our review. In April, we did the initial agency review of our branding, advertisements, and written materials, and we provided agency approval and denial letters to the plans. At the same time, if you'll recall, we came and spoke to the Medical Care Advisory Committee in April and asked for your assistance in reviewing the branding and written materials that we had received up to that point, and asked for your assistance in looking at them and advising us of any areas of concern that you may have had with the materials. We received several sets of comments back, and we appreciate your participation in the review and consultation process. It's been very valuable. Some of the types of comments that we received, DCF noticed that some of the materials contained the DCF call center phone number and requested that the plans not include that information on their marketing materials, because it would only add to the volume of calls going to the DCF call centers, and instead suggested that the plans instead include their website address so that folks would take advantage of the materials on the Access website and be able to enter their applications and other questions through the web page rather than overloading the call center numbers. And so we did send additional follow-up letters to each of the plans asking them to remove the DCF call center numbers from their materials. In addition, I think there were a few plans that had included some eligibility information that was either vague or a little bit misleading, and so we asked that to be removed from the materials as well. There were some comments made by MCAC members about material that they thought was potentially misleading or may offer some comparison between plans that was inappropriate. In those cases, we did send a request to the plan to change the wording, to maybe remove a word or alter the phrase so that it didn't lend itself to that type of concern. There were a couple things that we missed in our initial review that some of you noticed. One of that was there was a reference to MetaPass that we overlooked in our review, and we appreciated you pointing that out to us so that we could advise the plan to remove any references to MetaPass or to the old Choice Counseling phone numbers or web addresses. So it's been it was very helpful and very useful to have your feedback and your concerns as we went through the review process. So in May, we provided that feedback that we got from the Medical Care Advisory Committee members back to the plans and requested that they make the additional changes to the items that we had already sent an approval notice out. We also, in May, notified the plans that they could resubmit items that had been denied for a second look. And during June, we did a review of those resubmissions and then sent those out with our comments to the plans. We also asked the Medical Care Advisory Committee earlier this month, we mailed to you a CD that contained all of the approved, the agency recommendations for approval to you and requesting your feedback on those items as well. So if you haven't had a chance to review those, of course, we would appreciate if you have the time and the interest and would like to provide us some comments, we would be more than happy to receive those. Also, during June and July, we did the hiring for the marketing unit in the field-based plan management unit in Tampa, and we now have a permanent staff for our marketing unit, and that will allow us to expand upon our activities and begin to do the next steps in the review process. The flowchart that you're putting up next, right? Yeah. The review process flow is something I think that we shared with you during the April meeting, and it pretty much looks the same. One of the things that I think is most important to note is that a really important component of the process flow is the review from the Medical Care Advisory Committee. We do value your feedback, and we will be working to establish a process where the materials will flow from the marketing unit to the Medical Care Advisory Committee members for review before an approval is sent to the plans or a denial, so that we can incorporate the MCAC review into the process rather than do it as an after thought, you know, to the process. I think these two initial phases, we decided that we really needed to get the materials out to the plans, but for an ongoing process, we want to be sure that the Medical Care Advisory Committee review is an integral part of the process. before we actually reach the approval or denial stage. So one of the things that I wanted to kind of pose to you today is the marketing review cycle that we are looking at implementing. Our objective, of course, is to establish a regular marketing review cycle so that the plans can submit new or changed materials on a regular basis and can provide for review and consultation from the Medical Care Advisory Committee members. So on the next slide, we just put together, it's not working. That's okay. I'm going to go to my bigger one. It gives me a second to fumble here. Okay. So what we're looking at is about a 6-week review cycle where we would propose to have the plans be able to submit any new or revised or resubmission materials to our unit by the 5th of each month. Between the 6th and the 15th of each month, the agency would conduct their review of the materials. And then by the 20th of each month, those materials that were recommended for approval would be sent to the Medical Care Advisory Committee members for review, and denial letters would be sent directly to the plans. During the end of the month, the 20th through the end of the month, we would ask for the MCAC members to provide their feedback and hopefully get those to us by the 5th of the following month. Then between the 5th and the 10th of the following month, we would review the Medical Care Advisory Committee members' comments and feedback. We would apply that, do any necessary escalation with senior managers, and then send out the approval letters to the plans and or denial letters by the 15th of the month, so that we would then be on a regular schedule for those materials that would include branding, scripts, written materials, promotional items, and nominal gifts. There will be a separate process for reviewing and approving events that will operate on a little bit different time frame. But this would be the review cycle for those materials that the plans want to use. So what's next for us? Well, we're getting our unit up and running, getting our staff trained. We will be completing the branding and written material resubmission review from the materials that the plans submitted in June, and requesting your feedback on those items. That's the material that we mailed to you a couple of weeks ago. And then we are in the process of developing review tools and providing staff additional training on marketing events and related materials. We would like to implement the marketing review cycle if that schedule meets with your approval for review and approval of marketing materials. And then our next big project will be to continue to develop our secret shopper program. We've already done a couple of activities where we have deployed field staff to events, just to see what types of materials plans are actually handing out, to ensure that they haven't jumped the gun on agency approval for events. So that's pretty much where we stand right now. I'd be interested in your feedback on our proposed review cycle.
Is like a trick. Hi, Ellen Anderson, Florida Hospital Association. I reviewed the CD that you all gave in. Now, how is it that you want the feedback? You just want that through email on
that
it?
That would be
or
perfect.
Do we, okay,
yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So just email. We don't discuss it, though. Is that right? Or
you're more than welcome to give us a call if you'd like to.
No. I just wondered how logistically you wanted all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So thanks.
We have someone on the phone with a question.
Or do you want us to submit these, or do you want to hear them here in the committee? There are major concerns about the materials that were submitted.
We would, on a regular basis, we would like for you to be able to just send us your comments via email. If you have any particular issues you'd like to discuss today, we'd be happy to hear them.
I do. I noticed in all those materials that were sent out that when the health plans were sending out that advertisement, with Florida statute, nurse practitioners are primary care providers, and yet all the material was focused on one set of providers. It did not include the other sets. So we're looking at kind of a disproportionate viewpoint there. So I'm thinking that what we should do is, because, you know, there's nurse practitioners, PAs, you know, are 30% of the primary care workforce for Medicaid, it would certainly either make the advertisement provider neutral or make it in such a way that their contribution to Medicaid can be recognized as well.
Thank you.
I should probably speak to that just a little bit, Stan, just so I'm clear. You know, as a physician, the nurse practitioners are not independent in their primary care provision. So I'm not sure if I understand what you're asking.
You're correct, Dr. Thacker. However, with Florida Statute 464, all we're required to have is a collaborating physician, and a lot of our collaborating physicians do not see Medicaid, but their nurse practitioners will. So what we see is we have nurse practitioners in these rural areas usually that are seeing these Medicaid patients, and when the plans come in and they advertise for physician services, yet they send them to a nurse practitioner, that causes confusion. And it also may increase our complaint line as well. So that is basically what we're looking at, especially in, I can speak for Area 2, seeing how I live in that area, that's a big problem area that we've run into.
Thank you. Just to insert here, I do appreciate that there are points of tension potentially between.
No, there's no tension. Mr. Secretary, please don't speculate there.
Yeah.
But I'm in total agreement with Stan, and I employ two nurse practitioners in my practice. I'll be honest with you, I couldn't serve on committees like this without their support and assistance. So my concern is just from this committee's viewpoint in terms of, you know, what we would be required or what we can require and what should be legal, in the sense that we want to promote access, but we don't want to be misleading,
right,
to anybody. That's all.
The committee's responsibility is to review the materials, and the word is review. I think that when you get into the idea of approval, then we're off on a little bit of a different tangent. What we want is some input about the advertising and about the marketing. I think the plans can use that information to learn about the impact that their marketing has, and maybe to try to refine their marketing message. It also is designed to try to catch outright errors. If there's a wrong phone number, or there's a wrong website, or there's something that is incorrect on the advertising, it's designed to catch that. What we've tried to do with the marketing is we are trying to align our marketing requirements with Medicare's marketing requirements. We are not trying to create new rules. We are not trying to be prescriptive. We are not trying to be regulatory in the way that we go about it. The plans are trying to reach consumers, and they're trying to reach consumers in a way that helps them learn about the program and learn about the options that are available to them. And I would assume from a plan's perspective, they're trying to say things that would encourage that consumer to join their plan. As long as they're not saying something false, as long as they are not trying to mislead or they are putting incorrect information out there, as long as they are not using superlatives or certain language that we don't want them to use, we're going to try to follow Medicare's guidelines. If Medicare allows it, than we're generally going to allow it, because we want the plans to be able to coordinate across those two lines of business and to be able to coordinate more effectively for recipients, and we don't want the plans to have to respond to two completely different regulatory frameworks and to incur expenses associated with that.
I just a clarifying question, if I could, on this. When Dr. Thacker brought up a point earlier where he said that people in Jefferson County who he's treated, that they may not be able to come see him if they were, if I understood it, on a plan where he wasn't a provider on it. So I was just curious, with respect to this marketing, if he were to write a letter to his patients and say, you're soon to be presented with a choice. There are two plans in Jefferson County, A and B. A and B. And I'm a provider under A. I'm not a provider under B. And if you want me to continue to treat you, you have to select A. He's not a plan, so I assume he can communicate in that way, and there wouldn't be any issues with y'all.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Steve Grigas. I'm with Ackerman Centerfit Law Firm. Just a quick question. In terms of the coordination between the agency and the marketing aspects that the agency is proposing and the Department of Financial Services and OIR, is there coordination that's going on between them? Or because it seems like, for instance, marketing agents are regulated by the Department of Financial Services. And I was curious as to the involvement or how the two different departments, you know, are, if they're working in tandem or if this is all separate and apart.
Do you want to take that one?
We have the agency. This is David Rogers. The agency has a variety of interactions with OIR on a variety of fronts, including that there are specific provisions in the contract related to registered agents, and there's reporting on the managed care plan on a routine basis for registered agents that are involved in marketing, including agents who have their licenses terminated by OIR. So we are seeing that. That is a regular report from the managed care plans.
We are trying to the best of our ability to align the Medicare and Medicaid marketing requirements. However, there are some differences in federal law between the two programs that don't allow us to align them perfectly. I think agents assume a much larger role in the Medicare program than in the Medicaid program because of the way that Medicaid prescribes a lot of that type of activity and will continue to do so. We don't have a waiver from the federal government to allow that type of marketing in Medicaid. I don't think one would be forthcoming even if we asked for it, but we didn't ask for it.
This is David Rogers again. It is a different context if you think about the, you know, commercial insurance where an agent could sell you a product. You don't really sell Medicare per se, but they actually enroll individuals in Medicare. In Medicaid, you're not selling it per se, and agents cannot enroll individuals in Medicaid. That has to be done through the enrollment broker. So we're watching that regulatory scheme, but it is a different context for how agents work within the Medicaid program.
Stan, you recognize.
I just want to clarify. What we're talking about is choice. You know, it's not nurse practitioner against physician. That's not what we're talking about. What I want is the patient to have a choice to see who's going to do the best job for them. If they, and Dr. Thacker's a fantastic physician and human being both. If they want to see Dr. Thacker, I'd like for them to be able to see Dr. Thacker. If they'd like to see me, I'd like them to be able to see me. So I think giving them the choice is what we're looking at. And I hope Dr. Thacker agrees with me in that regard. And what we're looking for is the best outcome for that patient, not necessarily a professional biased. So I think opening that up to where, you know, patients can have an understanding, oh, well, that physician team that's supposed to come see me as a PAMP team, or that, you know, that physician really did come see me, you know, in that physician care thing. So, I mean, it's just, I just think that maybe we could head off a little difficulty there.
Can I add, this is David Rogers again. Just kind of wanted to reiterate that this is what we're asking the advisory committee to do is really take a look at marketing materials, and all of the marketing materials are really optional for the plan. In fact, we have a plan that's not doing any marketing, no materials. It's really, as Justin mentioned, and Sue went over kind of the definitions about promoting a plan to potential enrollees. It doesn't take the place of the required material that we have, provider directories, for example, enrollee handbooks. I mean, those are required things that all plans have to do that have certain specification. This is, you know, kind of optional material, if you will, that a plan may elect to or may not elect to use, you know, within the confines of the rules that we have to, again, kind of promote individuals, to attract individuals to their plans.
This may or may not help, but one of the things that I noticed, it's Ellen Anderson with FHA, is that, like, for Molina's marketing materials, they taped a bunch of stuff on there. So that was, like, one of the things that I'd noticed, that I don't know if it was just because they didn't get to the printer in time to, like, when they resubmitted, or what the deal was there. But, I mean, are those the kinds of things that you're looking for in our feedback?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then the only other thing I had was that, since we're just talking about it, First Coast Advantage, we're talking about a population in Medicaid that doesn't necessarily always have a computer. The only thing that they have on their billboards is a website. So it may or may not be helpful if you're a Medicaid beneficiary. You're not going to really know to read that small bottom line where it says that First Coast Advantage is a managed care plan with a Florida Medicaid contract. So you're not going to necessarily know as a Medicaid beneficiary, possibly, that it would be a health plan or what exactly it is, or a phone number to call. Because how are you know, if you don't have a computer, you're not going to be able to get online. Those are the two things. So are those similar?
We have certain things that we would require a plan to put on its advertising. There are some disclaimers. We are not, I don't view us as necessarily policing the quality of the advertisement. Okay. So if they've given a methodology for contacting the plan that someone doesn't have, that's kind of, they probably need to refine their message, but that's really up to them as opposed to us.
Exactly.
So more Medicaid recipients have web access than you might imagine.
Yeah. We did get several comments on grammar and formatting and that sort of thing. Our philosophy is that we're not necessarily editors, you know. So, you know, if the plan wants to put out material that's embarrassing to them because they don't know how to spell, or, you know, don't know how to punctuate or use proper grammar, you know, we will sometimes note it if it's really glaring, but we're not going to edit their copy. Any other questions?
When it comes to advertising, you can... Yeah, when it comes to selecting a plan, you can call our choice counselors, or you can go online. So there are toll-free numbers that you can call, or you can go online. And if you call in, you can actually speak to an operator if you'd like, or if you've already made a choice, there's actually press 1 for this plan, press 2 for that plan. There's an option that you could use for voice recognition that would allow you to choose a plan electronically. Or you can ask for a choice counselor and speak to a choice counselor. What we did is we mailed out letters, significant numbers of letters to all recipients. I think they each got 4 in the advance of the rollout of the program, talking about this program is coming, talking about their assignment, telling them there's 30 days left in their choice period, one other letter that was sent to them, and it gives them the numbers that they can call and a website that they can go to if they want to find out more information about the plans available in their region.
And it did have the brochure.
Yeah, and it did have there was a brochure as well that listed them, but... to find out, really, to get to get to the nitty-gritty of the plans, you needed to have a little bit more contact than that.
I just know in times past, managers of group homes waited for the state to make assignments. They didn't even bother to look at the materials to see which plan would have been. You know, there might be 8 in a group home. There might be 10. They all have different needs, and they basically waited for the state to make the assignments.
When it came to our home and community-based services programs, we had very intensive choice counseling. The long-term care program, we were dealing with about 83,000 people, and we rolled it out over the course of many months, not a 4-month period, but even longer than that. And we actually were able to offer face-to-face choice counseling to anybody that wanted it in the long-term care program, and we'd actually go to the site where they lived. And one of the goals there, we had a different set of goals in terms of defining the success of the rollout. One of the goals there was to make sure that no one, as a result of the rollout, or a minimal number of people would have to move as a result of the rollout, so that the home that they were in, whether it was a nursing facility or an assisted living facility, actually had contracts with the various plans, and the residents in that home wouldn't have to move as a result of the rollout of the program.
But the residents are not capable of making the choice. It would be up to their house managers to make those choices.
Also family members, and we had a verification process to determine who had the right to make a choice on an individual's behalf. Sometimes it was folks at the facility. Sometimes it was folks.
There is no family.
Sometimes it was a family member, and we would make sure that they had the power of attorney, that they would get into our record so that we could show that the person that made a choice on their behalf had the authority to make that choice. Well, let me, we will go ahead and adjourn this meeting, but right before we do, let me give it to Melanie, to Melanie Brown-Wifter from our office. She can give some instructions about what's going to happen next with the subcommittees, and then we will adjourn.
Hi, this is Melanie. We are going to continue with our subgroup or our subpopulations advisory committees after this. There is a call-in number that's on the agenda, so we are going to stay dialed in, and if other folks want to join us, they may. The call-in number is 1-888-670-3525. Okay, so that's the same number that's there. And then the participant code is 371-527. 4100 followed by the pound sign. So we'll give a few minutes for other folks that may be joining us, and then move forward. So are you going to formally adjourn us?
The meeting is adjourned.
Okay, with that, we'll end the Medical Care Advisory Committee as the whole group. We're going to move on to the subcommittee planning session that Melanie Brown-Wifter is going to lead. Anybody who's here is welcome to stay. It's going to be a brief planning discussion, and anyone on the phone is welcome to stay for that conversation as well.